She found what she wanted and turned the book around to show Nikki. That is Zena, with Maddie. The photo, taken in the harsh glare of a flash, was bleached but clear enough for Nikki to make out the smiling faces. It showed several women at a bar, drinks in hand. Where was this taken, Spooks? The Briar. It was someone's birthday, I think.
Anna's, added Bliss.
Nikki looked at the woman beside Madeline Prospero. Zena Paris was indeed no hard-faced battle-axe. She was stunningly and delicately beautiful. Bliss looked over Nikki's shoulder.
Zena must be in her 40s. She's about your height and slender, with an incredible figure, and rich chestnut hair that almost reaches her waist. She often wears it swept up like in the photo.
Enough! I'm starting to get jealous! Spooky assumed a fierce expression.
Well, you have to admit.
Spooky stuck her nose in the air. Me? I've hardly noticed her. She gave a lascivious grin. Except those eyes. You forgot them. Dark and mysterious like liquid pools. Touché. Bliss aimed a cushion at Spooky.
Hey, assault! Inspector, you witnessed that?
Were Maddie and Zena an item?
Nikki was still looking at the picture.
No, said Bliss, but they go way back. We don't really know the history, but they were good friends.
If they were such good buddies, I wonder why Zena's name never came up on our list of Madeline's contacts.
Like we said, Maddie was very clever at keeping her private life under wraps.
Nikki gave a wry smile. I could have done with her on my team. She would have made a good detective. She paged through the album. And these women? I recognize Dr. Sylvia Caulfield and the two with her, and that one is a local solicitor, but who are these two?
Bliss looked over the page. That one is Charlene Crawford. She works at the Greenborough Hospital. And that one is Maria Lawson, the opera singer.
Oh, yes, I recognize her now.
A muffled ringing emanated from her handbag, and she pulled her phone out. It was the station.
This had better be good.
Nikki listened.
Joseph? Nikki, there's been another killing. Can you talk right now?
No.
Then can you ring me back?
Give me 5, okay?
Use my mobile number, said Joseph.
Affirmative, and thanks. I appreciate your call. She turned to her friends.
Well, that's police work for you. Gotta go. Seems they just can't go up without me.
Spooky went to find her coat. Frowning, Bliss looked at Nikki.
Something serious?
Nikki smiled awkwardly.
I don't know. I hope not.
She thanked them and put on her jacket. All the very best for tomorrow's interview. Come and see me afterwards, promise?
Spooky nodded. Nikki stopped in the doorway. And don't forget about the candle in the window. It honestly wasn't such a rubbish idea.
Nikki raced to her car and rang Joseph. She's not actually on your friend Spooky's list, Nikki. But she is related to someone who is. Rather worrying, wouldn't you say?
Who is she?
Louise Lawson, the daughter of Maria Lawson, the opera singer. Maria just happens to be number 7 on the Briar Patch membership list.
Jesus Christ, I've just been looking at a photo of her. Are you in the CID room, Joseph?
Yes, I came back because I'd forgotten something and the balloon went up while I was here. I rang you straight away.
I'll be there in 5.
Nikki made it in 4. Where? When?
Joseph looked pale.
The kid lived in a flat in Tennyson Street with a couple of other students. One of her flatmates found her a couple of hours ago.
Same method?
There was a fraction of a second's delay before he replied. Not exactly. Prof. Wilkinson is already on site, and he reckons she was stunned, then tied up, and her main arteries severed.
Joseph took a deep, shaky breath.
D.I. Mercer took the shout. She said it was worse than slaughterhouse, Nikki. Reckoned it was a total bloodbath. The friend who found her is in Greensboro Hospital, poor kid. She just flipped.
And the mother, Maria? Has anyone spoken to her?
Not yet. She was singing at a charity concert. Jill Mercer said that she's travelling back from Yorkshire as we speak. They haven't tried to contact her. They couldn't give her that kind of news while she's driving.
Joseph flopped down into a chair.
Nikki, I haven't told D.I. Mercer that there is a connection to the Madeline Prospero case. Considering what the super said, I didn't know what you wanted to do about it.
Nikki wasn't too sure either. She sat down opposite him.
I was at Spooky's when you rang. She and Bliss have had a rethink about the Briar Patch women, and why they are anxious.
She told Joseph what they had said. He looked thoughtful.
Do you think they might have a point?
I do. They probably all think the attack on Madeline was homophobic. And maybe it was. We need to talk to Jill Mercer, but I'm not sure how much to tell her.
Nicky sighed.
She's over at the Lawson's place right now, said Joseph. Maria's husband was away too, giving a lecture or something, but he's back now, and Jill's gone to see him.
At least Jill doesn't know about the Briar Patch connection, so she can't put a foot in it.
Nicky shrugged off her jacket. Joseph watched her.
So, if Jill has people already out there, there is not much we can do until the morning, I guess.
I'll have to take it to Greg Woodall first thing. He'll know the best way to tackle this, she answered.
Then she stared at Joseph and blurted out, I'm so sorry. I was hateful earlier. I don't know what I was thinking. Forgive me.
Oh, it's not your fault, Nicky. I've been totally neglecting you. It's my fault entirely.
Joseph lowered his head and shook it.
Everything is getting on top of me. I'm just not coping with things as I should.
Tell me.
Nicky took his hand and gave a small smile. You can even include red 4x4s parked at your place in the middle of the night.
Oh, Lord.
Joseph looked down at his hands.
She just turned up. I didn't know what to do. She was sobbing her heart out. She's so screwed up about her job and Gavin, that bastard of a boyfriend.
Has she actually lost her job?
Let's say that since she took that drug company to court, her services are no longer in demand.
Joseph pulled a face.
Her employers haven't actually sacked her. They still have to pay her something because it would look bad if they ditched her because she told the truth, but it's nothing like what she should be earning.
On the gorgeous Gavin.
Joseph looked up.
He had wanted her to refuse the case right from the start. He saw which way the wind was blowing and told her she would be committing professional suicide.
Which she did? He nodded.
Yes, but at least she was true to her beliefs. She acted in good faith, and she can sleep at night.
Alone.
Gavin liked the good life that her income provided. He was all sweetness and light until the money dried up. Then he emptied their joint account and buggered off.
Ouch!
Precisely. I'm not sure which of the two disasters has affected Laura most. I suspect it's Gavin's duplicity.
Nicky nodded.
I'm not surprised. It's always the personal stuff that really hurts. And I guess when she stood up to Big Pharma, she knew what she was going to get, but it must have been a complete shock when Gavin turned out to be a total asshole.
I think you are right.
Joseph rubbed his hands together as if he were cold.
She was really out of control last night, Nicky. I'm surprised you didn't hear her screaming. I've never seen her like that before.
Nicky thought about it. Yes. You always described her as level-headed, sensible and caring, especially where Tamsin was concerned.
Joseph looked pained.
She was. She was all that. She had a lot to contend with when I was in Special Forces, but she took it on the chin. And the way she has studied and become such a powerful figure in her field has been amazing. She had an important position in the WHO, until this expert witness thing blew up in her face.
I'm sure she'll bounce back, once her hurt over Gavin has eased a bit.
Does she have any plans?
Nicky looked at him.
As I said, she's a mess at the moment. I don't think she's got it in her to plan anything.
Joseph puffed out his cheeks.
And I seem to be the only one she's got to offload on. She keeps ringing me, wanting me to meet her, and now she's turning up at Knott Cottage. I don't know what to do for the best.
Nicky had never seen him look so miserable, so this was why he had been so tired and preoccupied.
Last night I finished up giving her a couple of large brandies and sticking her in the spare room for the night. I heard her get up around 3. I thought she was going to the bathroom, but then I heard her car pull away.
He shrugged.
She was well over the limit. But I checked with uniform, and there were no drunk drivers pulled at that time last night. I suppose that's something to be grateful for.
She's not your responsibility, Joseph, Nicky said gently.
I know. But I can't just ignore her.
Tamsin is back tonight, isn't she? Won't that take the heat off a little?
The kid has just got married, Nick. She's on cloud 9. I can't dump all this on her doorstep. Maybe I just need to give Laura a bit of time. Grief and hurt do turn to anger, don't they? If she becomes seriously pissed off at Gavin, then she should regain some of her old toughness.
Nicky had a niggling suspicion that the lovely Laura might just be playing games with Joseph.
Let's hope.
She squeezed his hand.
And I was a great help, wasn't I? Behaving like a spotty adolescent. What a prat!
She gave him an apologetic grin. I'm over that now. So is there anything I can do?
Just be patient. And help me to see this through. She'll be off again as soon as she's come out of this everything's-against-me phase. She bloody well better and sooner rather than later.
Nicky smiled. Just keep talking to me, Joseph. I can handle anything then. It's the not knowing what's happening that gives you the heebie-jeebies.
I will. I promise.
So let's go home, shall we? I suspect tomorrow is going to be a very long day. And Laura might have to find another shoulder to cry on, because I'm going to keep you working your ass off.
Despite the late hour, a number of people were still making their way across the town bridge. It was cold and dark, and collars were turned up against the biting wind. Most scurried along, anxious to get out of the cold. But there was one who hung back. The lone figure stopped, leant over the handrail, and stared down into the deep tidal waters below. What had happened? It had never been like this before. The euphoria of that first kill had gone. Tonight's slaughter had been a complete shambles. Nothing had gone the way it should. But worst of all was the emptiness. There had been no satisfaction. None at all. There should be elation right now, not misery. Misery, frustration, and anger. That was all. But oh, so much anger.
Chapter 9.
Superintendent Greg Whittle sat staring at his desk. Looking at him, Nicky guessed she wasn't the only one who had no idea how to proceed. Greg coughed.
Naturally, there should be no withholding of information between departments. The I-Mercer cannot be expected to conduct an inquiry if her own colleagues are keeping evidence from her.
He inhaled.
But the murder last night that is closely connected to another name from your list has complicated matters.
He looked very grave.
This stays between you and me. You understand? I'm afraid there is a high-ranking officer, currently investigating a suspected case of corruption, who it appears is a member of this society.
Bloody hell!
Nicky pulled a face.
And is she also keeping her sexuality hidden? She is divorced, with two sons. She has an unblemished record, and her lifestyle has always been heterosexual in all respects.
Nicky bit on her thumbnail.
We should talk to her. We will, or rather I will. But until we've had a chance to speak to the members individually, the fewer people who know about this club, the less chance there is of causing some kind of witch hunt. We certainly can't provoke a bloody media fest.
Sir, what if I take Jill aside, give her the facts and ask her to keep it to herself until we fathom out how the hell to play this? I know she's stretched to the limit right now, but as you say, we can't keep what we know from a colleague, especially when she's working the same case.
He gave her a tired smile.
My thoughts precisely. Ask her to keep on with the Louise Lawson investigation exactly as she would normally, but liaise with you all along the way, okay?
Understood. I'll go and talk to her right away.
Oh, and Nicky? We have another small problem.
Greg frowned.
Part of the CID room needs to be closed off for a week or so. Maintenance has detected a leak behind the wall cladding that's threatening the electrics, so the partitioning needs to be stripped out. I'm told the room will still be usable, but I suggest that your team relocate to the old mess room. It's big enough, and you'll be out of the way down there.
Nicky snorted.
Well, out of the way. Has it even got electricity?
It'll be much better, Nicky, really. Especially as your other investigation is an old crime.
Nicky thought about it.
You're right, sir. We could conduct an orgy down there and no one would know. I'll go see Jill, and then I'll get the team to start moving house.
Nicky?
Greg called her back.
I'm beginning to see what you meant about the homophobia. Earlier this morning I overheard several officers having a private laugh about lezzies and dykes, and their tone was far from complimentary. I think I must have had my head in the sand recently.
Not everyone, as I said, is as accepting as you, sir.
I could, but I won't, give you the names of two of our very finest officers, and both keep their sexuality a closely guarded secret. And very few have the courage, self-confidence, and downright balls of Rory Wilkinson, do they?
Greg grinned.
Very true, Nicky, but I'm not sure I could cope with a station full of Rorys.
Nicky found D.I. Jill Mercer alone in her office, and it only took a few minutes to explain the state of affairs. As she hoped, Jill understood the situation immediately, and they promised to be open with each other. Nicky marched back to her team and explained about the move. Then she grabbed Joseph, and they ran down the stairs to inspect their new basement home,
Well, it's not luxurious, but the old place does have space.
Joseph shrugged.
Why not? I'll go tell the guys and girls to gird up their loins.
He disappeared, and Nicky was left alone in the disused mess room. It had only one small window, and the door led out to the bottom of the fire escape, but the long fluorescent lights were bright enough. It would do very well, and they would have more privacy than in the big main office or the swanky serious crimes murder room. In no time, Joseph, Cat, Dave, and their new addition Ben Radley had arrived with brooms, cleaning materials, and refuse sacks. Nicky watched Joseph. He seemed much more enthusiastic today. By 11 o'clock, they had 3 working computers and 3 telephones. One wall held a large pinboard, already scattered with sheets of white A4 paper with names and dates on them. In pride of place, on a well-scrubbed formica table, stood a small stainless steel copy machine. Cat refused to tell anyone where she had got it from. She then produced a set of china mugs, fresh coffee, sugar, and an unopened box of UHT milks and creamers. Nicky turned her attention to the Gordon Hammond case. Yvonne Collins was the source of most of their information, and there was more than enough to keep the whole team occupied for some time. Madeline Prospero had to take precedence, Nicky knew, but the memory of Gordon Hammond's harrowing death, if indeed it was he, continued to haunt her. Dave Harris had seated himself on a rather elderly chair. He looked around the makeshift murder room with evident satisfaction.
"Just like the old days, apart from the computers, of course. This old place is the perfect setting for a 1970s investigation.
I'll see if I can find you an old Hillman husky to do your house-to-house inquiries in."
Cat grinned at her old partner.
"And if you get home on time, you might just catch Crossroads," added Ben. "Or Starsky and Hutch."
"Very amusing, kiddies. But we did real police work back then, you know. We had no computers, smartphones, or DNA.
Uh-oh, he's off. When I was young..."
Nicky smiled at her team.
"Right, playmates, if we're all sitting comfortably, then I'll begin."
Nicky told them about the murder of Louise Lawson the night before. She said that D.I. Jill Mercer would be handling the case, and they would continue to help with Madeline Prospero until such time as they could amalgamate the two. "The super is going to tell us how to proceed with interviewing the Briar Patch woman. Until he does, we push on with Gordon Hammond and Fred Cartwright." Nicky looked to Cat, the leader on this case. "I'm going to suggest that you keep Yvonne with you, and also Ben. He will be looking at Fred Cartwright. But as it's connected with Quinton Ordyke, I think it best that you work together. Is that okay with everyone?"
There was a low murmur of assent.
"Joseph, Dave, and myself are at your disposal, Cap. Over to you."
It took 2 hours to sort out the list of Quinton Ordyke's inhabitants. Most of the younger generation had grown up and left, but the old people had stayed put in a marshy time warp. Quinton Ordyke was a ghost village.
"So it's time we got out there and started talking to them."
Cat looked at the worksheet she had collated.
"Dave, see if you can get hold of Gladys Hammond's sister, the one she went to stay with after her daughter Avril disappeared. Yvonne's excellent pocketbooks tell us that Gladys left Quinton just before her husband's supposed suicide and went to this address in Cambridge."
She passed Dave a paper with the details.
"Yvonne, how about paying a visit to your old mate, Sergeant Ron Barnes? You know where he lives now, don't you?" "Yes, I'll go as soon as I've cleared a few things here." "Mom, would you and Joseph mind trekking out to the boggy wastes of Quinton Ordyke? Remarkably, the village still has the same GP, Dr. John Draper. Let's see how good his memory is, shall we?"
She looked at her list.
"And there's the old school caretaker, a man named Sid Wilson. He said he would be prepared to talk to us."
Cat stopped speaking. Someone rapped at the door.
"Oh, lovely. Dray chic."
Professor Wilkinson stuck his head around the door and beamed at them.
"They told me that the A-team had relocated, but I had no idea your new accommodation would be so very retro."
Nicky raised her eyebrows. "Welcome to our new home, Rory. I was just sending out for the Mivy lollies. Can we interest you?"
"Ooh, mine's a whopper, if you don't mind."
"Trust you to lower the tone. Now, what brings you to our ancient pile?"
"I am here because I promised D.C. Harris that I would be."
Rory handed a sealed envelope to Dave and bowed.
"And before you all trot off out, I suggest you take a look at it."
Everyone looked at the pathologist.
"The blood on the jacket, previously identified as belonging to Gordon Hammond, did not come from your skeleton."
There came a chorus of, "Oh, shit," Then silence fell. Rory held up his hand.
But, as you know, DNA is the blueprint of life.
Nicky detected the hint of mischief in his voice.
Skip the lecture, Wilkinson, or you won't get your whopper. Now, what haven't you told us?
D.I. Galena, you are no fun any more. You are catching on far too quickly. Well, here it is. The blood belonged to a cat.
Bugger. So we're no further ahead than we were before.
Dave puffed out his cheeks.
Such a disappointment.
Rory lowered his gaze like a forlorn schoolboy.
Hang on a minute, Professor.
Dave almost shouted.
I was there when you checked Hammond's jacket, remember?
So you were, Dave, dear heart. So you were. Oh, well, game over. I found a hair with the root still attached, and several other bits that we could lift the DNA from, and I made a positive match. Your mystery man, so long as the jacket's ownership is not in dispute, is most certainly Gordon Hammond.
Nicky felt a rush of relief.
Rory, I swear I'll swing for you one day.
Nonsense, detective. You love me dearly. Now I must get back to the lab. As you will no doubt have heard, business is brisk at the moment.
Nicky followed him out into the corridor. Rory, any chance of a prelim copy of the autopsy report on Louise Lawson when it's ready? Like, just before you officially deliver it to D.I. Jill Mercer? I badly need to be one step ahead of everyone at the moment.
Naughty, naughty. You know better than to ask a thing like that.
Then Rory whispered,
I'll slip it under your door in a plain envelope in the dead of night.
On my desk in ASAP would be fine, thank you.
As I said, you're no fun at all.
Chapter 10 The signpost for Quinton O'Dyke swayed drunkenly. After a sudden sharp bend, the narrow lane crossed a sludgy ditch, straightened out and widened into a long, endless drove. Acres and acres of cabbages and Brussels sprouts stretched before them in various shades of green. In the distance, the sun glinted off the spire of the tiny church of St. Thomas. Nicky parked in a narrow lay-by outside the church lychgate, and then got out to survey the hamlet. All the houses and a few shops clustered around the church, as if huddling together for safety.
Where does the doctor live?
Joseph pulled his jacket tighter around him. The strong wind almost carried his words away. The Lime's on the High Street, next to the butcher, so I'm told. They walked, bent into the gale, along the main street, searching for the butcher's shop, or a house called the Lime's. Nicky looked up and down the deserted road.
Not exactly a hive of activity, is it? Ah, this must be the butcher's. Well, it was.
The windows were boarded up. Little remained of the paintwork. The weather had stripped it clean in places. A faded sign above the door read, Cyril Roberts, Master Butcher. The doctor's surgery was set back from the road. It was a fine old Victorian house, in much better repair than its neighbour. The front door swung open at Nicky's touch, and they stepped into a big, welcoming hallway. There were chairs around the walls, and wherever there was space, a pot plant, a vase of flowers, or a table covered in bright magazines or children's books.
"I'm sorry, but there is only morning surgery on a Monday. Is it an emergency?"
The woman had a kindly face. Nicky thought she would have been quite pretty in her younger days. "I'm Detective Inspector Nicky Galena, and this is Detective Sergeant Joseph Easter. We would like to speak with Dr. Draper if he's free."
"May I ask what it's about? I am his wife, Linda."
A shadow of concern passed across her smiling eyes. "We'd like to talk to him and you too, Mrs. Draper, about the events of the late 70s and the 80s, particularly Gordon Hammond and his family."
"Oh, no, not again. I do believe we will go to our graves with the name Hammond ringing in our ears."
She shook her head and turned down a short corridor.
"Come this way, Detective Inspector. He's in his study, although I don't know how pleased he will be to see you. I suppose I'd better make some tea. We may need it. John, it's a pleasure to see you. It's about the Beast of Quinton again."
Mrs. Draper gave a rueful smile and held the door open. Dr. John Draper was seated in front of a small, pot-bellied, wood-burning stove. He looked up from his medical journal in astonishment.
"Good God, he's been dead for donkey's years. What can I possibly say that has not been said already?"
He stood up and shook hands with them. He was a tall man, with a full head of dark, wavy hair, and a face as craggy as a moorland tor.
"Have a seat, and tell me, why now, when the man has been food for the fish for nigh on 3 decades?
"Because he hasn't, Dr. Draper. Last week, Gordon Hammond's body was found in a graveyard in Greenborough. The autopsy showed that he had been murdered." The doctor's eyes were wide.
"Are you sure about that? He was a seriously disturbed man, Inspector."
"Stabbing yourself twice in the back, then caving your own skull in, is a difficult manoeuvre to pull off, Dr. Draper."
"Good Lord! Well, that's a turn-up for the books."
The doctor ran a hand through his hair and whistled softly.
"Now I understand why you're here. Shall we wait for Linda? Her input could be useful. She may recall things that I don't."
Soon they were all drinking tea, and Linda began.
"My husband fought like a demon to get the parents to allow him to talk to those poor children. But they were adamant. It was awful seeing those youngsters suffer and not being allowed to help them."
"Why were the villagers so reluctant to get help for their children?"
Joseph asked. The doctor sighed.
"You have to understand that we are talking about a backward rural community in the 1970s. They were a close-knit group."
"Close, as in incestuous in some cases," added his wife.
"It's true. As Linda says, a lot of the families were, and still are, intermarried. Cousins marrying cousins and so on. They believed in keeping Quinton's problems to themselves. Anyone from outside the village was regarded as a foreigner and not to be trusted. Even folk like old Ron Barnes, our local Bobby. He came from West Saltaby. It's 5 miles away, but he was still an outsider."
"We are from just outside Boston, and we might as well have been from Alice Springs, as far as the villagers were concerned. We still haven't been completely accepted after 43 years.
Linda raised her eyebrows and shook her head.
"They are an odd bunch, to say the least."
Nicky was beginning to like the couple. "Tell us about the children. What happened to them?" The doctor sipped his tea noisily.
"There were lots of different kinds of injury and, well, torture, really. But all the children had one thing in common. They had been terrified into silence. They were too frightened to speak out against whoever had hurt them."
"Were they sexually abused?"
"I believe so, although I could not prove it. I was only ever allowed to examine one child thoroughly."
"How many children were involved during this period?" The doctor and his wife looked at each other. Linda looked remorseful, as if they had let the children down.
"We think about 8 or 9. Some John never saw professionally at all. We just heard gossip and noticed the awful changes in the young ones."
Nicky took a notebook from her bag and looked over to the doctor. "As I said, this is now a murder inquiry. I wonder if you could provide me with a list of the children and their parents' names, addresses too, if you can remember them." The doctor nodded. Linda Draper stood up and, moving heavily, went to a small oak bureau. She took out a creamy white sealed envelope.
"No need, Detective Inspector. When Sergeant Barnes first came to us with his suspicions, we started keeping a record. We hoped that one day it would help send an evil man to face justice. We thought of destroying it, but never did. It is unofficial, of course. Parts are just observations. Some is pure conjecture."
She handed Nicky the envelope.
"They are all there, Inspector," added the doctor. "Names, addresses, dates. It ends when Avril Hammond was killed and her father's coat was found out on the marsh."
"The Avril Hammond case was left open, Doctor. She was never found."
"Who would know where to look out here on the fens?"
"True." Nicky looked at the neatly written pages. "This is far more than we could have expected. We do appreciate it. It will make our lives considerably easier." She passed the sheets of information to Joseph, who studied them eagerly.
"This is brilliant, Doctor. We already have a list of the population of the entire village and its environs, but this will cut down our interviewing time no end."
Joseph looked through the names and uttered a grunt of surprise.
"Mom, look, Frederick Cartwright. No wonder Yvonne said she recognized the name. They were living here when the troubles started."
Joseph read aloud.
"Frederick and Ellen Cartwright to the cottage End Drove, March 1968. Daughter Millicent brought to surgery, having fallen into a bramble patch. On examination, the lacerations, scratches and bruises were not consistent with the purported accident.
One of the cuts was most certainly caused by a sharp-bladed instrument, and a set of three bruises were believed to be from fingers grasping the girl's arm. Millie remained silent throughout the dressing of the wounds, and we did not see her out playing, or with the other children, from that day for at least 2 months.
The doctor and his wife were looking from Joseph to Nicky.
"What else can you tell us about the Cartwright family, Doctor?"
"Let me see. Ellen died back in the 70s. 73 or 74, I think. She picked up a really bad chest infection, and by the time they called me, it had turned into pneumonia. Millicent went abroad, Australia, not New Zealand. Fred sold up and went to stay with his sister, I think. Can't tell you any more, I'm afraid. How about you, Lynn?"
"Not really. Old Maggie, Lily Harvey's sister, used to keep in touch with him after he moved away, but she's quite gaga now. I don't think she'd be much help to you. Why are you interested?"
"A Mr. Frederick Cartwright passed away last week, sudden death. We couldn't find much at all about his past. It seems that your excellent record-keeping may have answered another of our problems."
"He was living around here?"
The doctor looked puzzled.
"Greenborough."
"How odd. We never knew. The way news travels in these parts, you would think someone might have mentioned that he'd come back."
"He turned into something of a recluse, we believe."
"Ah, well, he had suffered such a lot. Perhaps I can understand that."
"Doctor, can we ask you about Gordon Hammond? We know something about him, obviously. One of our officers was on the original case, and we know he was suspected of abducting and killing his daughter Avril. Do you have any thoughts on this theory?"
"More tea, please, my darling. This could turn into a long session,"
the doctor said to his wife. Linda Draper collected the cups and left the room. She paused in the doorway.
"The less I hear about that man, the better."
The doctor turned to them.
"We're in two camps over this matter, Detective Inspector. My wife is adamant that Hammond was the pervert who terrorized the children, then finally turned to murder." "And you don't think so?"
Joseph was interested to know why. Dr. Draper was the only person so far not to have condemned him outright.
"I can't really say. He was a strange man, moody, bad-tempered and rude. His son died tragically and had to prescribe him tablets for a while. The locals picked on him because he didn't like drinking with them in the running horse. He kept himself to himself, and because of his temper, they reckoned he beat his wife. To my knowledge, Gladys was never beaten. She didn't have very good hand-eye coordination, as they put it nowadays."
He chuckled.
"Let's say you would never have given Gladys your new car to park. She fell over things, walked into things, dropped things. She was born clumsy, and because she was always bruised or injured in some way, the rumour spread that Gordon knocked her about."
"And what about the girl, Avril? How was he with her?"
"He adored her, evidently. She was a bright kid, and as far as I know, she lacked for little. Gladys came from a good family, but they disowned her when she married Gordon. Stupid, really. He was a damned hard worker and provided for them as best he could."
"He broke his wrist, didn't he?"
"Fell from a barn roof. Didn't come to me until a while after. I ran him to the hospital, but it was too late. They wanted to operate, to re-break it, but he didn't want to be away from home. They did what they could, but it always bothered him in damp weather."
"Do you think he was capable of murder?"
"His best friend swore that he couldn't have done it, and I was tempted to agree with him. But who knows?"
"Who was his best friend?"
"Our old neighbour, the butcher, Cyril Roberts."
Nicky recalled the deserted butcher's shop.
"Is he still here in Quinton?"
"Sort of. He moved to an old cottage near the river, on the outskirts of the village. We hardly ever see him any more. His girl lives in Greenborough, and his wife and he split up not long after Avril disappeared."
"Where did she go?"
"Nowhere. She's still here. She's got a terraced cottage in Midville Lane down by the pond. Not a happy woman, that one."
Joseph was still writing notes.
"Sounds like they were in two camps as well. I'll say. They were at war. Cyril's wife always swore that Gordon had harmed their child in some way, but Cyril would have none of it."
The doctor opened the cast-iron doors of the stove
and pushed in two logs. He looked into the fire.
This is purely conjecture, so don't hold me to it, but I think Cyril Roberts suspected someone else. It was only after Gordon's disappearance that he began to concede that his friend may have done those terrible things after all.
And now we know that Gordon was murdered. Any ideas about who could have done it?
Anyone and everyone on our list. Or even all of them.
I'd say it was a very private trial and execution carried out by Quinton O'Dyke's native-born citizens.
The door opened, and Linda Draper appeared with a second tray of tea.
I'm really sorry, Mrs. Draper, but we have to get off now.
With a regretful look at the knitted tea cosy and china cups, Nicky stood up.
Your help has been invaluable, and I'm sure we will be back again with more questions if you don't mind. Thanks again.
Linda Draper showed them out. When they reached the door, she touched Nicky's arm.
It was Hammond that hurt those children.
I know it.
Nicky stopped and looked at her. She sounded so certain.
Do you know something that your husband doesn't?
Linda Draper looked troubled.
I was somewhere I shouldn't have been, and I overheard one of the children actually saying it. They named Hammond.
Nicky drew a breath. Which one, Linda?
Which child?
The voice was little more than a whisper.
Avril Hammond, on the day before she disappeared.
She clutched at Nicky's arm.
I can't talk here. I'll ring you later. It's 6 o'clock.
The door closed behind them. Rory Wilkinson pulled off his mask, tore off the sterile examination gloves, and threw them in the waste bin.
My mother always said I would have made a wonderful florist. But did I listen to her?
He stared at the cold, eviscerated body that lay on the autopsy table. The woman, little more than a child, really, had been beautiful once. Now she was slit open from jaw to pubis.
What I'd give to be tying a pink ribbon on a bunch of pretty freesias. But what am I doing instead? I'm slicing up the bits that our killer missed, and there weren't many of those, either.
One of the mortuary assistants looked hopefully at the clock.
Can we return the organs to the body cavities now, sir?
I'm going through a career crisis here, Charlie. But you don't care, do you?
Can I take that as a yes, Professor?
Charlie, listen to me. You can get out while there's still time. Go and be a hairdresser or a hod carrier. Anything but this.
Rory waved his hand at the body on the table.
I was rather hoping to get off at 5 tonight, sir.
Rory gave an exaggerated sigh and told his assistant to leave the tidying up.
I'll do it. It appears I have little better to occupy me at present. Leave her to me. Is your sidekick also trying to escape, or do I have to wash down and clean up as well?
Charlie pushed the plastic bag containing the heart, lungs, esophagus, and trachea back into the chest cavity.
No, you're okay. Spike is in no rush tonight. We wouldn't both desert you, would we?
So, what tears you away from my obviously less than dazzling company? A hot date, maybe?
Something like that. Though I'm not sure how hot yet.
Warm is good. Warm is hopeful.
Tepid is, well, a bit iffy. I'll remember that, sir.
Spike had yet to return from his tea break, so Rory completed the work on Louise Lawson alone. He ran a finger along one of the deep, jagged gashes in the girl's thigh and tied it a lock of her corn-blonde hair. The sound of water trickling in the background could just be heard above the hum of the ventilator fans, and somewhere a printer began issuing reams of forensic data. Despite the occasional grouch, Rory was totally at home within these cold, antiseptic walls. The corpses and cadavers were all like beautiful puzzles that he tenderly and painstakingly solved. He was as comfortable in the mortuary as others are on a deserted beach, or strolling through a fragrant pinewood. But today, looking at the lifeless form of this pretty teenager, he felt strangely dispirited and more than little uneasy. Spike, named for his particular haircut, returned to begin cleaning down the tables. Rory briefly wished that his old technician Matthew was back with him. Matthew had moved on, having spent several years working with Rory. He had always taken Rory's wicked jokes in good part, and Rory missed his humour.
Charlie and Spike were competent enough, but neither had Matthew's spark. If Matt were here now, Rory would have told him about the alarm bells that were ringing. He sighed. He would just have to wait. Sid Wilson had spent most of his working life looking after the Quinton School. Nicky was surprised at how much he remembered about the countless children that had come and gone during all those years.
"They were bad times, make no mistake."
The old man rubbed his arthritic hands together.
"My wife and I thought of moving away, but..."
He shrugged.
"This was our home. Both our families came from hereabouts, so where were we to go?" "Anywhere would have been better than Quinton," thought Nicky. "I was the one who found little Lucy Clark after she had been hurt."
Nicky recalled seeing the name in the doctor's notes. "What happened to her?"
"Hard to say. I found her alone in the boiler room after lessons had finished. I was doing my rounds before locking up. Poor little mite was huddled in that dark, smelly room, and I could say nothing to console her."
He sighed.
"She was terrified and shrank away from me as if I'd been the one to hurt her. It was heartbreaking."
"And she never said what happened?" asked Joseph.
"Never. It still upsets me to think about it."
The old man's eyes were moist, and Nicky decided to call a halt to the interview. She thanked him for his help, and they made their way back to the car.
"Some wounds never heal, do they?"
Joseph shook his head.
"Not the deep ones, no."
Sid watched them go. He hoped they would find some answers. Mysteries were fine in films and books, but not to live with for most of your life. That was not fine at all. He pictured Lucy's face, and the memories flooded back. It was nearly 6 o'clock when he finished mopping the long main corridor. The last of the teachers had gone, and he went through the old building, checking that all the lights were off and locking the classroom doors. When he saw all was well, he went down the steep stone stairs to the boiler room, where they kept the galvanized bucket and that old mop. The old place was quiet except for an occasional knocking in the hot water pipes that fed the big iron radiators in the classrooms, and the muffled roar of the boiler. He undid his long khaki overall and hung it on a free coat hook next to some freshly washed dusters hanging out to dry. Then he heard a different sound. It was like a cat mewing. He tried to fathom out where it was coming from. It sounded eerie. He took a step towards the broom cupboard, then another. His arm was shaking. He reached out to wrench the door open, but he couldn't do it. That sound, it was horrible, like fear and grief all mixed up, and it turned his blood to ice. He took a breath, and then he realized it was a child crying, and he pulled open the door. On the floor, pushed back into a heap of old curtains, was a little girl. He saw the creased uniform of one of the younger pupils.
"Sweetheart, whatever has happened?" he said.
The child drew further back and whimpered. At that moment, he just couldn't remember her name. Usually he was good with names. The kids liked him, and they often came to him with their problems. He was in a funny position, really. An adult, but not a teacher or a parent, and they knew he couldn't punish them. He stared at her tear-stained face. It was half turned away from him. Then he saw her long golden hair in those braids, tied with an emerald green ribbon.
"It's Lucy, isn't it?"
he said. He knelt down on one knee.
"It's only me, Mr. Wilson, the caretaker. You know me. He won't hurt you. Let me help you."
He held out his hand, but she cried even louder. She didn't seem to want to move from her hiding place. His mind was in a whirl. He would have to ring the headmistress. She would know what to do. As he started to get up, there was a loud knock on the front door, and he heard someone calling his name. He pulled back the bolts and saw Ron Barnes, one of the local bobbies. He was looking anxious.
"Sarge, am I glad to see you," he said. "I've just found one of our youngsters all crying and miserable in a cupboard. Won't budge for love nor money."
"Is it Lucy Clark, do you know?"
"Yes, yes, it is."
He practically dragged old Ron into the hall.
"See if she'll listen to you. Poor little mite, something has terrified her."
After a few kindly words and a few more stricter ones, Ron finally managed to crawl into the cupboard and lift out the child, now wailing out loud.
"Oh, my!"
He just stopped himself saying it, in case he upset her even more. He had seen what had made her cry so hard. When Ron put her down,
He turned her around, and he saw her hair. The right-hand side still had a long blonde plait, but the left braid had been hacked off. It had been chopped so close to the scalp that he could see tiny drops of dried blood on the little girl's head. The patch looked raw and tender, but he guessed that she was crying from shame, not pain. Lucy Clark had been righteously proud of her tresses, and if what people said about her was correct, she had precious little else. No wonder it had taken until now for her to be missed. They were a poor family. Her mum worked, and Lucy usually stayed at friends' houses until her mother got home. They'd never heard what had happened to her father. No one ever talked about him.
Who'd do an unkind thing like that?
Poor little kid. Ron Barnes knelt down beside her. She was trying to cover the side of her head with her hands. He looked up at Sid and shook his head angrily.
I'm going to have to let the doc take a look at her. There's quite a nasty gash on the lower part of her skull. And who knows what else the bast... Sorry, Lucy. Who knows what they used to make the cut? She might need a jab for lockjaw. You wouldn't ring the station for me. Tell my constable that we've got her, would you, Sid? The mother will be out of her mind with worry. And tell him to get round here as soon as he can.
He ran over to the school secretary's office and dialed the number Ron had given him. After that, he went to the stockroom and brought out a soft blanket to put around the child.
I'll carry her round to Doc Draper's surgery, Sid. It's not too far, and it'll be quicker than waiting for a constable to get here.
Has she said who did it?
He asked.
Not a word.
Ron looked very serious,
and from the look in her eyes, I'm not sure when or if she will. Thing is, we don't know if this is her only injury, do we? She may have been... Well, you know what I mean, don't you? Look, I'd better get to the doctor. Could you hang on here, Sid? He asked. We're going to have to search for any evidence. If it is an assault, this is very serious indeed. Don't touch anything. Just leave it all as it is for us to check, okay?
He looked at the pathetic bundle in Ron's arms.
Poor little thing. You get off and don't worry, I'll look after things here.
Sid rocked in his chair. He believed that whoever had hurt the child would be in custody by the next day. But now, decades on, there were still no answers. Just mysteries. Sid hated mysteries. Chapter 11
Come in, Ben. Sit down. And do try not to look as if you're about to shit yourself every time you see me.
Nicky fought hard to keep a straight face.
Sorry, Mom.
Ben Radley sat down, grinning in embarrassment.
I just can't believe my luck in getting on your team. I keep thinking I'm going to mess up.
Relax, Ben. I haven't publicly flogged a detective for, months now.
Nicky sat back.
Now listen, we know that our suicide case, Fred Cartwright, came from Quinton Ordyke. Does that throw any light on your inquiries?
I've just had the Quinton link confirmed, Mum. I put a poster up in the foyer downstairs. One of our civilian staff saw it and thought it might be the same Fred Cartwright. Fred's old neighbour in Churchgate Mews couldn't help us at all. She had no idea where he came from. She said he hated talking about the past. She did believe he was expecting a special guest, though, because he asked if she would bake him a cake. She said he seemed almost elated, but refused to say more. All he said was, Ben looked at his notes. Early days yet. We'll just have to wait and see.
That sounds as if Millie's visit was imminent, doesn't it? Any luck with hotels, guest houses?
No, Mum. It's hard enough to get people to identify someone from a photo, but when you have no idea what the person looks like, it's nearly impossible. I've been working on the age and the name Millie or Millicent.
What about New Zealand?
I'm waiting for the Christchurch police to contact me. The first address was pulled down years ago. It's now a supermarket, but the Kiwis are trying to trace the owner.
Okay, that's all then. Keep it moving, and get back to me as and when.
Nicky paused.
And we are very pleased to have you join us, Ben. As you know, Dave is retiring in a few months. He will still be with us as a civilian, but we will miss him out in the field. I believe you will fill that gap very nicely. Any problems, and I mean anything at all, come to me, okay?
Ben smiled, looking more confident now.
Kat and I talked about this, Mum, and you have nothing to worry about. We are both professionals, and we won't forget that. I promise you.
Nicky nodded slowly.
I believe you. But I also know that life has an uncanny knack of sticking spanners in the works. Just when you think you've got it all worked out, bam.
Take things one day at a time, Ben. See how it goes for a month.
Thank you, Mum. That's appreciated.
Ben left the office. The telephone on Nicky's desk began to ring. She glanced at the clock and smiled grimly. 6 o'clock on the dot.
Nicky Galena here, Mrs. Draper.
The woman sounded anxious.
He'll only be out for a short while, Inspector. He's checking on a patient. I hope you understand about me not wishing to speak in front of John.
Nicky let her continue.
Please understand, Inspector. I was, well, we both were terribly affected by what was happening in the village. I made myself ill over it. That's why John thinks I overreacted to what I heard. When I said I was somewhere I shouldn't have been, I was simply trying to talk to one of the children. I'd been warned before about speaking with the kiddies, so I met them by chance. Some of the children used to gather at the lich gate. There were wooden seats on either side, and they would sit and talk or play games under the cover of the roof. I was pretending to tidy up my grandmother's grave, and when I noticed them there, I made my way out by the lich gate. They didn't see me approach. Avril Hammond was sitting talking to Sylvie Smith. She was telling Sylvie that her father, Gordon, had killed her pet cat. She said he'd slit its throat. Then very quietly she added, "And it's not just animals he hurts." Then they saw me coming, and Avril ran away.
Did you tell the police this when Avril disappeared?
Of course, though everyone was certain he'd done it anyway. I'm sure I was just one of many who had a story to tell.
So who do you think could have killed him?
Bert Gilmore spoke most openly about sorting things out. Cyril Roberts told my husband that it was Gilmore who pointed the finger at Hammond in the first place.
But kill him?
I don't know.
Could there have been a modern-day lynch mob, do you think? You know how people can work each other into a frenzy. Nicky waited.
They were not hysterical killers out for revenge, Inspector Galena. They were simple working men, scared and superstitious. They muttered about retribution because their bairns were being terrorized and they were frightened. I just don't see them baying for blood.
So who could have done it?
Someone who kept it to themselves. A parent whose child had been damaged and took it very badly. I would imagine that eventually the hate boiled over.
Do you have anyone in mind?
No, Inspector. You would have to speak to them yourself, those that are left. That awful time changed the folk of Quintin. People were no longer their usual friendly selves, and sadly they still aren't. The children have grown up. Most of them have left the village. But none of them speak of it, even after all these years. None.
Linda Draper sighed.
Hammond damaged this village, and the scars will never go away. He was an evil man.
Nicky heard her give a slight intake of breath.
John is home. I hear his footsteps on the gravel. I hope I've been of some help. Goodbye.
The phone went silent, and Nicky heard the words, "He killed her cat." It had been cat's blood on the jacket. Nicky yawned. Time to go. She pulled out a few reports to read at home, and then put them back. Not tonight. She would eat, then spend the evening with a good book and a glass of red wine. Nicky lit the fire, more for company than warmth, and rummaged around in the freezer.
"Joseph Easter, you really need to get back to normal soon or I will run out of things to eat."
She pulled out a container labelled Joseph's Red Hot Chili and a small bag of frozen rice. For Nicky, this was real cooking. She grated some cheese and opened a bag of tortilla chips. She enjoyed her meal, although she missed Joseph's company. She went into the sitting room, put down her glass, and settled near the crackling log fire. After reading the same line three times over, Nicky gave in. Quintin O'Dyke had slithered into her thoughts like stinking marsh gas, and she couldn't let it out. She poked at the glowing logs, sending showers of bright sparks singing up the chimney. There was little point in going to bed with her brain in overdrive. She might just as well stay here, have another glass of wine, and go over what was on her mind. Dave had established that Gladys Hammond, along with her sister, had died. No living siblings remained. She wondered if Linda Draper's comment about incest was true. In that case, anyone could be related to anyone. Nicky considered the two Drapers. They were almost inseparable, yet poles apart in the case of Gordon Hammond. Nicky sipped her wine. She was looking forward to hearing from Yvonne. Vonnie's old mentor, Ron Barnes, could turn out to be an invaluable source of information. Thoughts of older, wiser people led Nicky to her mother. After what had happened to Louise Lawson's daughter, maybe it wasn't such a good idea for Eve to join the Briar Patch. Then again, she reached for the phone.
"Eve Anderson?"
"Mum, it's me. How are you?"
"I'm fine, dear, and you?"
"I'm missing Joseph's marvellous suppers, both the food and the company, if you must know."
Oh, dear. Still being nursemaid to the ex, is he? She seems to be having some kind of nervous breakdown, and she's leaning very heavily on Joseph. Eve snorted. Breakdown? I suspect that having been jilted, Laura is jealous and trying to entrap your Joseph. He's not my Joseph, Mum. He's far more yours than hers, and you know it.
Nicky didn't answer.
Don't worry, sweetheart. Joseph is no fool. He'll soon see things as they really are.
But he does have his family to consider.
Don't forget that Joseph wouldn't have a family at all if it wasn't for you. It was you who brought Tamsin home, wasn't it? And you who made her see her father as he really is. Don't underestimate Joseph's feelings for you, Nicky. He cares very deeply, and he won't let the drama queen have her own way for too much longer.
She paused.
Joseph's only problem is that he's too nice. He doesn't want to hurt anyone, not even that witch, Laura.
Nicky didn't ever remember Eve being so emphatic. Thank you. I'll hang on to those words. But before you take up work as an agony aunt, I have a little job for you if you're interested.
Oh, bring it on. Is it dangerous? I do hope so.
Eve, it's just a little bit of covert ferreting, that's all.
Ah, the best kind. Can I wear a disguise?
Nicky laughed. No, I want you to be your charming self and get friendly with one or two members of a certain private club.
Sounds intriguing.
There is a downside. Nicky told Eve what she knew about the Briar Patch.
Oh, I've heard all about that place, dear. In fact, there's a good chance I may be invited to attend.
Oh?
A friend of mine, Grace Campion from the Art Club, is a member. She said she'd sign me in if I ever wanted a woman's night out.
Nicky tensed. Grace Campion was one of the Briar's elite women. Who better for Eve to become friendly with?
Well, sod that for a game of soldiers. Here I am, struggling to find scraps of info about the place, and you've already been invited. I don't believe it. It's not what you know, my darling, but who?
So it seems. Grace is one of the women I'd like you to talk to.
Interesting. So how can I help?
I'll get back to you tomorrow, when I've had a chance to speak to Joseph, and also to a woman called Spooky. I want to use her to liaise with you.
Spooky? How fascinating.
Her proper name is Sarah Jukes. She's an IT boffin, a friend of mine, and a member of the club.
Oh, and you never call her by her real name, okay?
Then Spooky it is. A few minutes later, Nicky rang off. What a stroke of luck. All at once she felt drowsy, and decided to have an early night while she could. And tonight she would not look across to Knott Cottage, but simply pull the curtains. She hoped that Eve was right, and she and Joseph would have their old life back before long, and the red 4x4 would be gone. For the second time in half an hour, Rory picked up his duvet from the floor. He was worried. The late news had mentioned guerrilla fighters taking hostages in the area where David was working. There had been no phone call from him for 2 days. This would not normally have unsettled him. After all, it was a nasty little cesspit of a country, and mobile phones were almost useless there. Even a 3 or 4 day silence was not unusual. But the news report had worried him. Moreover, the Lawson girl was still on his mind. It would take days to complete a full post-mortem report. He got up, wandered to the window and stared out. Their top-floor flat afforded him breathtaking views across the town to the fenlands beyond. It was especially beautiful after dark. Tonight, though, it was sinister. The fens looked bleak, dark, and almost frightening. Why had David chosen a job that took him to such dangerous places? Trying to banish thoughts of David from his mind, Rory returned to Louise Lawson. She had shared a flat with 2 other girls, which was open house for dozens of hedonistic, fun-loving, unhygienic students. Rory and his team had collected samples of every type of secretion, fluid, hair, fibre, flake and general detritus that human beings could possibly shed. It was proving a nightmare to analyse all this, and it would take time. Sadly, there were no shortcuts, because their last visitor had been a particularly unpleasant one. Rory wasn't a drinker. His father had been a violent alcoholic. Louise Lawson had been drinking. He wondered if she had been drinking with her killer. What was it that disturbed him about the Lawson girl? Rory could not think. He returned to his dishevelled bed and lay down. He would have to wait. Wait to hear that his lovely David was safe, and for reports about the gregarious Louise Lawson to filter back in.
For once, Rory was as edgy and impatient as his friends in the CID room. He snuggled down, absent-mindedly reaching across to David's side of the bed,